change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, your weekly program of analysis of our jobs, our incomes, our debts, the futures facing our children in terms of their jobs and their incomes, everything about the economy, that system that produces the goods and services we all depend on. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for a variety of outlets, including truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of economic analysis and reporting daily. Please check them out at truthout.org. We also maintain two websites where all of the kinds of analysis you hear on this program can be explored at your leisure and at no cost in many ways. And I invite you to learn about these websites, explore them, make use of them. That's why we update them on a daily basis. The first is rdwolf with two Fs, .com. That's rdwolff.com. And the second one is Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info. Not only will they provide you with lots of additional material, including entire courses, lectures, video interviews, and so on, but they will also allow you to communicate with us, to tell us what you like and don't like about these programs, to let us know if there are radio stations in your area that you can connect us with, where we can get this program to be broadcast. We've grown from 1 to 35 stations in the last 3 years. We'd like to double or triple that growth, and with your help, I think we can do it. And I also welcome emails from you if there are places you'd like me to come and speak in your area where we might organize such a trip. I do a good bit of that, and I would like to extend that as well. And finally, by visiting our websites, you can also click on an icon and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and so keep even closer tabs on our constant growth and our activities. I want to begin today by mentioning a development recently that got a bit of attention but needs some explanation. The attention it got was because it was about Walmart, the largest employer, a private employer in the United States. And Walmart announced that it was cutting the medical insurance it provides for about 30,000 of its workers. And here was the interesting part of the story that wasn't picked up by so many. Some commentators said, oh my God, what a terrible blow for these 30,000 families, which it no doubt is. But others noted that these families might actually end up having lost their coverage where they are employed, making them eligible for certain kinds of medical insurance under the Obamacare system that was not available to them when they were employed and got medical insurance at their job. So that some commentators said, well, it's not so bad for the 30,000 families. To which I want to respond, even if that were true, look what it means. A private employer is going to be saving millions of dollars because the private employer, already a wildly profitable enterprise, is dropping medical insurance for 30,000 people. Even if those people can get a better insurance policy, it'll be because we, the taxpayers, are now paying that cost, along with those individuals, but it's paid by the program, the federal government funds. This is one of the many ways that private corporations use laws designed to help people to help themselves and to shift the burden of programs from their own backs onto those of the mass of people. The next time you are upset about the taxes, Medicare and other kinds of expenses you have that are withheld from your check, please remember that much of what you pay has been pushed onto you by corporations that found ways to make laws and regulations designed to help the average person enable them to shift the cost of something from themselves and their balance sheets onto you. My attention has also been caught by a recent report from the Pew, that's P-E-W, Pew Charitable Trusts, about the scandal of payday loans. So I want to tell you a little bit about them. 12 million Americans, the estimates are, make use of payday loans. That's an awful lot of people. 12 million people. Here's what they do. A couple of weeks before payday, they go to one of the loan agencies that does this, payday loan companies that operate in storefronts or on the internet as their major places, and they get a loan which they intend and hope to repay on payday. And indeed, they have to pledge the income they earn when they get paid as part of the way they get these payday loans. They're intended for a couple of weeks. They usually extend, it turns out, for an average of 5 months. They're automatically renewed because the people can't make it. We're talking about the people who live on the weakest and poorest incomes in the country, who are paid very poorly by their employers. So their payday doesn't amount to very much, and they can't get by. Here's the scandal. The average interest rates paid for the lump sum online payday loans, hold on to your hats, 650% when you annualize it, when you work out what it is on an annual basis. Wildly more than any other kind of loan. Because not only do you have to pay a high interest, but you have to pay it much sooner than a year. So if you worked it out on what it comes to on a yearly basis, it is so enormously high. In short, it's a scandal that the people with the least end up paying the most for the desperate loans they have to take out precisely because they are so poorly paid. That's why there is a movement to get a $15 minimum pay, minimum wage in the fast food and retail industries, etc. Because these folks are ripped off. Not only do they get paid less than most of us, but they have to pay much higher interest rates and so on and so forth. It is a scandal, and the Pew Charitable Trust is to be thanked for bringing it to our attention. By the way, out of our 50 states, 15 states prohibit online payday loans. The scandal has meant at least 15 states have tried to do away with that. Of course, the crisis is if you don't provide a payday loan, the people who don't get paid enough may have to turn to even more dire solutions to the financial problems that come from paying so many so little. On the same note, not to get you all depressed, my attention was caught by a report from the Juvenile Justice Information Exchange. You can see what they do by going to the website jjie.org. They did a report on child poverty. This caught my eye because the government reported a very modest improvement in the child poverty rate. In other words, the number of people caught in what we officially define as child poverty got a little better over the last year or two. But my hopes in that regard were dashed when I read their October 3rd report, Child Poverty Rampant in Many of the Biggest U.S. Cities. So I wanted to mention the five worst cities in terms of child poverty. Okay? This is the percentage of children that live in poverty in the five worst cities of the United States. Detroit, 59%. Cleveland, 54%. Fresno, California, 48%. Memphis, Tennessee, 46%. And Miami, Florida, 44%. Wow. Children living in poverty. This is staggering. And what's most important, we could have done all kinds of things to prevent this. We should have. There's no way you can blame the children for the poverty they live in. Why are we not doing something for this crucial problem? If ever there were innocents suffering needlessly, here it is. I want to read a statement by a man named Ed Walls, a spokesman for First Focus, a bipartisan Washington-based advocacy organization trying to deal with child poverty. Research shows, says Mr. Walls, that growing up in poverty has lifelong effects, less academic progress, worse health, and lower wages as adults. Congress's failure to address child poverty today will cost the nation for decades to come. It is a stupid as well as cruel economy not to tax the extraordinary wealth of the top 1/10 of 1% of Americans, a small amount that will make no difference to their extraordinary wealth, but that could transform the millions of children being condemned to lifetimes that flow from child poverty, and to condemn the rest of us for having to pay the costs of their poor health, their poor education, all of the other social ills that Mr. Walls lays out so clearly. The next update has to do with a court case. This one is so grievous that I want to bring it to your attention so that you don't miss it. The Supreme Court is hearing arguments over the last couple of weeks about a case basically brought by a temp hiring agency that works with Amazon. The case was brought by an employee at Amazon named Jesse Busk. Jesse Busk. Here's his complaint. He's been working at Amazon for many years. His job is to run around those cavernous buildings that Amazon maintains so that when an order comes in for a book or a toaster or an appliance, his job is to run up and down the aisles, find the object, and ship it out to the person who made the order. He works and runs and walks several miles a day, he points out. But that's not his complaint. He does that. He earns poorly because Amazon doesn't pay well. Here's his complaint. At the end of every day, he is forced to wait in line, usually for about 25 minutes, to be screened by a security device installed by Amazon to protect against employees taking things home that they're not entitled to take home. If he didn't go, he would lose his job. It's required by his employer. Mr. Busk's argument is, if I'm going to be required as part of my job to stand in line for 25 minutes, those 25 minutes should be paid. It's part of what I'm required to do, and I will lose my job if I don't do it. I certainly don't want to. I do this because it's required. Amazon doesn't want to pay. The temp agencies that work with Amazon, they don't want to pay. They basically want to require 25 minutes of Mr. Busk and thousands of other employees without paying them. It's gone all the way up to the Supreme Court. It had to, because the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the last level of the courts before you get to the Supreme Court, agreed with Mr. Busk and told the temp agency in Amazon that one or the other of them had to pay for the 25 minutes they required of their employees. But of course, the temp agency and Amazon have appealed this decision all the way to the Supreme Court, which will now hear the case and decide. If that's were all about this case, it would be a sad story and a case of injustice if ever I heard one. But that's not why I'm telling you. I'm telling you because the appeal to avoid having to pay thousands of workers for the 25 minutes of standing in line And by the way, just between you and me, why is it 25 minutes? Because either Amazon or the temp agency doesn't want to spend the money to hire the workers who could make the security screening go much quicker. They don't want to spend the money. They basically want the employee to suffer the time loss equivalent to their saving the money of making it quicker. Here's the sad news. The Obama administration, both the Department of Justice and the Department of Labor, have filed statements with the Supreme Court against Mr. Busk and in favor of the temp agencies and Amazon. Mr. Obama gives speeches about wanting to improve life for the middle class and for working people. This is no way to do that. This is a way to do the opposite. Next update. To be quick about it, the Consumer Reports magazine for September 2014 reports about the alarming use in the United States of opioids. These are pain-killing drugs. I want to read you the dramatic language Consumer Reports used to open their article called Deadly Pain Pills. Quote, America is in pain and being killed by its painkillers. They focus on four drugs called opioids. The name of the drugs are familiar, so I'm going to read them. Oxycontin, Percocet, and Vicodin. Recently, another drug has been allowed by the Food and Drug Administration of the same kind, called Zohidro-ER. I want to read you the results of the spectacular increase in the use of these painkillers. And mind you, I don't bring this to the attention of my listeners because I'm against painkillers for people who've had surgery and have serious problems dealing with pain. I understand that. But we have to recognize that companies are using a legitimate issue to sell wild amounts of these drugs to vast numbers of people who could and should be advised of the terrible dangers, but really aren't in any kind of way that would be reasonable in a society that was focused on safety, rather than a society that is focused on making wild profits for the companies that make these drugs. So here are the numbers released by Consumer Reports. Death from the overuse, the overdose of those drugs I just listed, are now running at 46 people per day. That's 17,000 people in the United States per year. That's up 400% from 1999. And for every death, more than 30 people are admitted to the emergency room because of opioid complications. No amount of profit justifies that level of killing and injuring. That burden on an overburdened medical care system, that way of sucking even more taxpayer dollars into a medical care system that is basically subsidizing the profits of drug companies. It's long overdue to look at this. And when Consumer Reports can make a report like that, it tells you something of major importance. I want to turn now, as we usually do, to major discussions of topics that deserve more extended conversation. I want to talk to you, because it follows directly from the opioid discussion we just had, about another set of scandals emerging from our medical industrial complex. Before I go into them, I want to remind you what that complex is. Four industries have banded together: hospitals, doctors, drug and device makers, and the medical insurance companies. Four different industries have banded together to defraud the rest of us of an amount of money for medical care that has no rival in the world among advanced industrial countries. We pay roughly 18% of our total income for medical care. the vast majority of other countries pay half or less for a medical care system that's just as good as ours, in many cases, produces better results in terms of longevity, of length of stays in hospital, and so on. It is a scandal at the most basic level. But I'm not talking about that. I want to go into some of the details so you can see why we pay so much more than everybody else for a medical care system that is no better than what many of those others have. And in recent weeks, we've seen examples. One of the scandals to get a considerable amount of coverage is the following. You go into a hospital for some operation, and you sign some papers. You don't pay much attention because you're scared about the operation. But basically, these papers say you will be covered by your Medicare or Medicaid or your private insurance, et cetera, et cetera, as long as you use in-network physicians that have signed up with your particular service or who accept your particular insurance. And then a funny thing happens. You get a bill later. And it isn't for your copay, your little portion, hopefully little, of what the cost is. It's for much more money. And why? Because during the operation, perhaps when you were anesthetized, you weren't even awake, they brought in a consultant, another doctor who helped the main doctor, and who turns out to be out of your network and therefore able to send you legally a bill for enormous amounts of money. This is a way doctors have of helping one another. I'll call you in to my operation as an out-of-network fellow who can then bill an enormous amount, and you call me. Doctors are doing this, and major newspapers from the New York Times on down have exposed them in recent weeks for the scam that this is. This is a way for doctors hooked in with insurance companies to get around the limits that insurance companies put on how much they reimburse a doctor for taking care of you. The doctors don't want those limits, and by being called in as an out-of-network consultant to somebody else, stopping in for a few minutes to give some advice, is a nice and easy way around the limits. This one taking more and more money out of the pocket, which helps explain why we pay so much more than other countries for a level of health care that is no better. Another scandal, again showing the complicated relationships between those four industries that make up the medical industrial complex: doctors, hospitals, drug and device makers, and the medical insurance companies. Another scandal has been the following. Billions and billions of dollars were revealed, and this is thanks to a provision of Obamacare. These numbers have to be made public. Billions and billions were paid in this year alone by drug companies to, and insurance companies, I believe also, to doctors and hospitals for seminars they might lead in some lovely resort in Hawaii, for training that they could get, for conferences that they could attend. Huge amounts of money, which were undisguised benefits given to doctors and hospitals when they went along with prescribing extremely expensive drugs. The drug companies, for example, made an enormous amount of money by this method of, how shall I say it politely, inducing doctors to write prescriptions for medical expensive drugs. Here again is a collusion between these four industries, who often fight with one another as they collude with one another to rip off the public. It is something that we should deal with. If it's clear, as all these reports show, that each of the industries is complexly conspiring with others, explicitly or implicitly, to give each other the huge incomes they get by taking money from one another and ultimately from the paying public, because that's in the end where it all comes from, we ought to question whether the single payer, having the government oversee the whole operation and run it, which is, by the way, the way most advanced industrial countries do it. Sometimes the government does it all. Sometimes the government oversees and supervises a partly public, partly private system. There are a variety of ways of doing it, but our way is corrupt. Our way is way too expensive, and our way doesn't get better results. You put all that together, and our way is not the best way. It may be the best way to give the 1 or 5% at the top the kinds of incomes they get. These industries are among the most profitable in the United States. Doctors are among the highest paid professionals in the United States. Drug companies are among the most profitable industries. It's clear why. We shouldn't be the suckers who pay for this. There's not a question of ethics, and it has nothing to do with socialism. It has to do with making an economy that doesn't work for most people into one that does. My next major discussion has to do with a simple statistical illusion, and I want to dispel that illusion in the interest of popular understanding and to make it a little harder for politicians to bamboozle that. I'm using here a report by Matthew Iglesias on October 3rd. If you can get on the website Vox, VOX.com. Again, October 3rd, and it's about manufacturing in the United States. It turned out that in early October, President Obama returned to a favorite theme of his, which is he talks about a manufacturing renaissance. Well, that's a powerful word. Renaissance literally means a rebirth. It refers to the time towards the end of the 1,000 years of feudalism in Europe when culture and sophistication and cosmopolitanism exploded in Europe, creating the modern cities and indeed modern European civilization. So a tremendous rebirth. So the idea of Renaissance, we're supposed to believe manufacturing is returning to America and taking off and really becoming a powerful part of our economy. Images like that come forth not only from President Obama, but from many other corners of the cheerleading for our quote-unquote recovery. So what's true and what isn't about this? Well, here's what's true. From 2010, which is about the worst time our manufacturing sector in America has ever seen since the Civil War in this country, from that time to 2014, we've seen a growth in manufacturing. It has come back almost to where it was in 2009. The problem is where it was in 2009 was awful. So to come back from how bad it was in 2010 to where it was, say, in 2009, is to come back to a disaster, not to come back in the sense that would be captured by the word renaissance or captured by the glowing projections of Obama and the Democrats running desperately into the November elections. So Mr. Iglesias did his homework as he should, and he went to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, which keeps a statistical record of what's happening in the United States that's as good or better than any in the country. It's called FRED, F-R-E-D. And you can get that by going to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. And here's what he shows. From 1985 to the present, what percentage of all the employees in the United States were the employees in manufacturing? How has manufacturing done as a share of our economy? Is it something that deserves the praise of the term renaissance? And the answer is an unambiguous no. In 1985, the percentage of employees in manufacturing, well, I'll give you the basic number, is in the neighborhood of 0.19, just to use the metric that they use. By 2010, it was in the metric of 9, 0.09. In other words, it dropped by half. From 1985 to the present, it dropped, including the so-called Renaissance. We are now half, our manufacturing is half as important as a part of our total economy from what it was in 1985, and that line is almost a continuous straight line down. Manufacturing has become a minor part of our economy, and nothing, underscore, nothing suggests that that's going to be dramatically changed anytime soon. It's pure conjecture, pure fantasy. It may come true, but nobody knows, and the signs don't point to that. They point to a long-term decline. We've come to the middle of our program. We will take a very short break, and then we will be back for the second half. Please join me. Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff, and the program again is Economic Update. I want again to remind you to make use of our websites that are available to you free of charge 24/7 that contain a vast amount of material updated every day. rdwolff with two F's .com and democracyatwork.info. Those websites will also give you access to us, ways to send us messages about what you like and don't like about the program, what questions you'd like us to respond to, as we do towards the end of every program, and to give us a general idea of what you would like this program to deal with. We read every one and we use them in shaping the content for each program. The websites also, and this is important, are ways for you to help us help you. The first is, if you would be interested in me coming to the area where you are listening or watching this program to give a talk to a community group, a trade union, a university, a college, I do a good bit of that. It's a way of bringing this kind of analysis to live audiences for a presentation and a real back and forth of the sort that radio cannot accommodate. If you're interested in that, email us. And likewise, we're looking for more and more stations to carry this program. Public radio stations, community stations, college and university stations, commercial stations, all are welcome. Use our websites, communicate to us, we will follow up and do everything in our power to make this program interesting for you to consider broadcasting or for the people you connect us with to consider broadcasting. Okay, we're in that part of the program where we're going to deal with one more major topic of discussion. And this continues something from about 2 weeks ago, where I talked about corporations and how they work. And a number of you went out of your way to let me know you'd be interested in having that continued and developed. Well, that's exactly what I'm going to do, and I'm doing it with pleasure. Okay, I want to talk to you about the relationships between a corporation and the government, the state, because there's more confusion on that subject than you can imagine. Just to bring us all up to speed, a corporation, again, is the way most business gets done in most capitalist countries. A corporation is owned by the shareholders who buy shares. 1% of the shareholders own about 2/3 of the shares, so ownership is highly concentrated. 1% of the shareholders, that's less than 1% of our population, owns 60%, 65 or so percent of the shares. They, the shareholders, decide who's on the board of directors. Every year, boards of directors of corporations are elected. They're elected under a system of one share, one vote. If you own no shares in a company, you have no share, no votes in deciding who's on the board of directors. If you have 50 shares or 1,000 shares, you have 50 or 1,000 votes. But if you have 20 million shares, which the major owners of many corporations have, well, then you have 20 million votes. The end result is the major shareholders decide who's on the board of directors. 15 to 20 people, and they're the ones who make all the decisions. What to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. So basically, the major shareholders and the board of directors, typically a tiny minority of all the people who work in an enterprise, they have all the power. The mass of people who work in an enterprise, the mass of people who live in the communities affected by the enterprise, own no shares, have no votes, or own a tiny number of shares and have an insignificant vote. All of the decisions are made by a tiny handful of unaccountable people. That's not democracy, as we pointed out. That's the opposite of democracy. We got rid of kings in our politics because they had too much power and we had to live with the decisions that we had no influence over. The irony is, in societies that call themselves democratic today, we go to work 5 out of 7 days, most of our adult life, and we enter the school, the office, or the factory, and there we enter a place where democracy is absent, where a tiny group of people make the decisions just like kings once did. We have to live with the results, but we have no effective power over them whatsoever. Good. What about the relationship between corporations and the government? Well, let's see. Corporations have to pay taxes. Part of their profits have to be paid in taxes to the government. Now, it's true, over recent decades, the share of the government's revenue coming from corporations has shrunk. Corporations have been very ingenious in coming up with countless ways to get out of paying taxes relative to what they used to have to pay. We've talked about that on this program. But still in all, corporations take a part of their profits and pay them in taxes to the federal, state, and local governments. So that's one way that they relate. A second way, corporations sometimes lease property. For example, ranchers lease land from the government. The government owns the land, leases it to the ranchers who graze their cattle. So there's another way a corporation can relate to the government. It can lease it, or it can have to pay for licenses and fees and all kinds of money move from corporations to the government. Okay, what do the corporations get back from the government? A whole host of things. First of all, just to give you a sample, the government maintains embassies in every country on the face of almost every country on the face of the earth, and most of what embassies do is look for opportunities for American businesses, places where American businesses can sell what they produce in whatever the country is where the embassy is located. Ways that an American company can partner with a company there to do research or to do any kinds of things. In other words, embassies have what are called economic attachés or business consultants, etc., and they provide a very important service helping American businesses make money by activities abroad. That's one. Here's another one. The government maintains the system of roads. Well, why is that important? That's crucially important. For example, few of us would buy an automobile if there weren't a road to run it on. Running our nice new car over a field of rocks and stones is not going to work. So if you think the automobile industry is profitable, you have to understand that the reason the automobile industry is profitable is it doesn't have to pay for the roads on which your car rides. By the way, the railroad industry didn't have that benefit. They had to build not only the trains that carry us, but the tracks had to be laid by them on which those trains run. The government subsidizes the automobile industry by providing free road construction to them. They don't have to pay for it, and free road maintenance. But it goes beyond that. By providing a system of roads, the government makes it cheaper and quicker for every store to be resupplied with the equipment the store sells. That is good for the store business, that the government allows trucks to move quickly on interstates at a low cost, no cost to the store, but the government picks up all that cost. The same is true of our harbors. The same is true of what the government does in the way of checking for the weather, letting us know whether we're having a hurricane or not, allows all kinds of savings to be had by businesses. The government checks on the hurricanes. The government maintains the harbors. You're beginning to get the picture. The government also maintains the money supply. We have the government printing and controlling the money supply, together with the banks, because we once tried to let money be handled privately by anybody who wanted to, and that was so disruptive of business, we got rid of that. And so we now have a more centralized, government-shaped, government-influenced monetary system. And on and on and on. The government educates the vast majority of people who work for a corporation. If a corporation has productive workers, it's in part because the government spent the money to educate the people who are now productive employees. Corporations benefit enormously from the fact that they don't have to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic to the mass of people. The government, at government expense, does that. So the services corporations get from the government are enormous. But I actually want to go to another topic that bedevils folks is trying to understand the relationship between a corporation and an enterprise. What I want to deal with is when those two merge, when they literally come together. And the example I want to use is when the government goes into business itself. Well, this is interesting. How does this work? Well, in a way, I've already mentioned it. When I said that the government runs a school system, that's like a business. The government has to build a building. The government has to put the right equipment in the building. The government has to hire the teachers and the counselors and the janitors that work in that building. So the government is functioning kind of like an employer producing a product, in this case, education. But the government, in the example of education, doesn't sell the product the way a corporation would. You don't pay in the United States for so many hours of kindergarten for your five-year-old or so many hours of high school for your senior, et cetera, et cetera. We distribute that free of charge. We use the tax system to raise the money that the schools use, but we don't function like a corporation. But sometimes we do, and I want to talk about that in particular. The government sometimes runs an enterprise where it sells a product. The post office is an example. Amtrak is an example. The Tennessee Valley Authority that produces and sells electricity in many states in that part of the country is such an example. Here the government runs a business, just like a business. It hires people, it produces a product, and it sells the product in the market. And people pay for the use of the product. Then the government is in business. The government is now a major part of the largest insurance company in the world, AIG, which it took over in the depths of the economic crisis in 2008. So in many societies, governments engage in production. When I used to go to France, because my family is French, I would sometimes buy a Gitane or a Gauloise cigarette. And I discovered that cigarette production in France is a government enterprise, as is the gas company, the electric company, the railroads, and so on. Countries differ into what portion of their businesses are government-owned and operated. Okay. When the government takes over a business in capitalist countries like ours or France or Germany, it functions just like a private enterprise, except it's the government that runs it. It's still, and here's the punchline that's so important, it's still a tiny group of people sitting at the top of the corporation who make all the decisions. It's not a board of directors elected by major shareholders. That's a private capitalist corporation. Instead, it's a board of directors composed of state officials, people put in that position by the political authorities, the president, the parliament, whatever that happens to be. The mass of people come to work in a government enterprise just like they do in a private. They work all day, they use their brains and muscles. At the end of the day, they go home and leave behind what they produced. Now to be decided what is to be done with that by the tiny group of people who make all the decisions. The workers are not the ones who democratically make the decision. If they were, then the term socialism might really mean something. But if you don't, if all you mean by the word socialism is that the government operates enterprises, which is what a lot of people seem to mean, well then, socialism and capitalism really aren't that different, are they? Because you haven't changed the fundamental life of a human being at the workplace. He or she is still coming in there, doing what they're told, and going home. Whether that's a board of directors privately elected by shareholders, or whether that's a group of government officials, probably isn't going to make that big a difference for most of the workers. It certainly isn't the transformation captured by the idea we have gone from capitalism to a radically different system called socialism. To make that kind of difference, you would have to transform the enterprise. Last point. Every capitalist society that I know of has made use of government taking over the business. Often it's for reasons that are not only not anti-capitalist, but are actually good for capitalism. In the United States, for example, we've periodically taken over the railroads. You know why? Because the railroads were in such a powerful position that they could jack up the price and make every other business that needed the railroad pay a very high price, and the other businesses didn't want to do it. And one way to get that problem solved, have the government take over the railroads and run them at a lower price. If the government then lost money, the taxpayer would have to make it up, and that was very pleasing to the average corporate businessman. So they were happy to have the government come in and take over. Calling that socialism because the government took over really misunderstands what's going on. Let me turn then, finally, to the questions for today. And I want to thank my friend Bob Hennelly for bringing to my attention a report on the securities industry in New York City. This report was prepared and released on October 2014 by the New York State Comptroller, Mr. Thomas P. DiNapoli. It's report number 9-2015. And I'm going to give you the name again because you might want to look. It's only 8 or 9 pages, but boy, is it a powerhouse document. And that's why I'm grateful to Bob Hennelly for bringing it to my attention. Again, the report is entitled The Securities Industry in New York City, prepared by Thomas P. DiNapoli, October 2014. It discusses what happened to the securities industry in New York City. Why is this important to everybody? Because most of the securities industry of the United States is located in New York City. It is the financial securities industry capital, if not of the whole world, then surely of the United States. And so we can see what happened to it as it went through this crisis that we all have been going through from roughly 2007 to the present, at least through 2013, the last full year for which we have data. And I think this report is a bombshell, and I want to tell you how and why. The first graph in this report, and as I say, it runs, let me just check here, not to give you any incorrect information, it runs 8 pages, so it will not take a great deal of time. The first graph is remarkable because it shows the security industry profits. How much profits did the industry make? And the profits are impressive, but they mosey along between $0 and $20 billion, roughly from 1990 to 2006. They're doing nicely, they're slowly growing, but they're in the neighborhood of $0 to $20 billion a year. Then in 2007 and 2008, the crisis hits, and they lose money. Not only do they earn no profits, but in 2007, they lost maybe $10, $11 billion in profits. And in 2008, they took a real hit. They lost over $40 billion in profits. Wow. Those were losses. Very bad. But now comes the extraordinary good news. In 2009, the securities industry earned over $60 billion in profits. In other words, in 2009, the profits of the securities industries in New York City completely recovered more than the losses in the 2 years of losses they've had in the last several decades, or at least the last 3 decades. Let me repeat that. In 2007 and 2008, the only years since 1990 that the security industry didn't have profits, they took losses, I would guess, in the neighborhood of $50 billion, $50 billion in those 2 years. In 2009, they made profits of over $60 billion. That is, they recovered all the $50 billion in losses, plus made another $10 billion. And they've been doing well in 2010, 11, 12, and 13. During those years, the average profits were higher than in the 20 years before 2007. Okay. In other words, make the statistics clear to you, the securities industry has completely recovered and then more some. It actually recovered from the losses of 2007 and 2008. In 1 year alone, 2009, it more than recovered everything it lost. And the years since have been very good years for the securities industry in New York City. Now let me compare it to the record of employment in the securities industry. Well, here we go. Before the crisis hit, January of 2008, we could also use July of 2007, it doesn't matter. But if you look at it here, you see that at that peak, the employment in the securities industry in New York City was 190,000 jobs. That's a lot of jobs. And as you'll see in a minute, it's a lot of jobs of people who get paid much better than the rate of pay in most other industries in the United States. 190,000 people at the peak of the securities industry before the crisis hits. In August of 2014, that's the latest date for which this report gives numbers, what were the number of people employed in the securities industry in the United States? And the answer is less than 165,000. So it dropped from 190,000 to 165,000. We're talking 15%, more or less, of a drop in employment. The securities industry recovered. The profits recovered, more than recovered. The profits are a story of great recovery since the depths of 2008, but not the jobs. The jobs see a severe downturn in New York City in the number of jobs. The securities industry is booming, but not for the employees that have not been called back. What about the bonuses? Well, here again, the highest bonuses were in 2005, 6, and 7. Then they dropped in 2008, but they were still substantial, and they have been growing dramatically ever since. Average salaries in the securities industry in New York City. Hold on to your hats, folks. It peaked in 2007 at $400,000 a year. It is now in the neighborhood of $350,000 a year. Average salaries have taken a bit of a hit, but nothing like employment and nothing like profits. And now, in a way, the most distressing. How has the securities industry related to the government of the city of New York? Well, I'm going to give it to you this way. What percent of the city's tax collections came from the securities industry at the peak of its success, 2007-2008, compared to today? Well, in 2008, and remember the tax payments received in 2008 cover the activities up to the previous year, so they don't reflect the crisis hitting. In 2008, the securities industries paid roughly 13% of the tax revenue of the city of New York. Securities industry-related tax payments. In 2014, that had dropped to under 7%. Half. The securities industry now provides half of the money to the city that it did as a percentage of the city's tax revenues of before. So to conclude, the securities industry, whose fiscal behavior, whose chaotic speculation with credit default swaps and other derivatives, played a crucial role in bringing this crisis to the United States and to New York City, more than recovered in 2009 from what it had suffered in 2007 and 8. It brought a crisis. It recovered very quickly. And part of the reason it did is it got massive help from the federal government. No way around it. Government help that was given to nobody else. That's why nobody else has a record like that. And they've made large bonuses. And they've made large profits ever since. They've been fully recovered from day one. All that they've saved on is laying off 30 to 40,000 people that they don't need anymore or have pushed to less important jobs far away, maybe outsourced to other countries. And they don't pay the taxes they once did to the city of New York. They're not as important as a taxpayer. They've done real well. Bring on a crisis, get bailed out ahead of everybody else, lay off lots of people, and give the city less of the taxes. Extraordinary. What we permit one industry to do while the rest of us look on in a kind of shocked horror. Thank you again for your attention. We've come to the end of our program. Next week, I will have a guest, Aubrey Hendricks, that you've heard before, and I look forward to spending that hour with you next week.